This is the Better Reading Podcast platform with stories behind the story, Jane's Be Better podcast, My Book Chat with Caroline Overington, and more. Looking for a particular podcast? Remember, you can always skip to it.
Welcome to the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story, brought to you by Belinda Audio. Listen to Belinda audiobooks anywhere, everywhere.
Hi, this is Cheryl Arkell from the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story. We talk to authors about how they came to tell us their story. Richard Osman, welcome back to Better Reading.
Thank you so much. Lovely to be back and in person this time.
Oh, I know, not via Zoom.
It's exciting, isn't it?
Oh, so exciting. I love it. I love having people in the office. Tell me, when was the last one? And that was the first one, wasn't it?
The last time we did this. Yeah, it was the first book, which would have been 2020, if you can remember back that far.
Yeah, it was COVID.
Difficult times, wasn't it? I know. Now we're sort of 10 million books in and four down and the most recent one out, which is lovely. And I get
it's
to be out in Australia and meeting readers, which is just an absolute dream.
Okay, so the first one was called... Oh, let me introduce you first. Richard is a household name in the UK. His tremendous knowledge of trivia led him to be presenting his own BBC quiz show, Two Tribes, along with insert name here, Child Genius and Richard Osman's House of Games. He then turned his hand to writing with the record-breaking Thursday Murder Club series. Book four in the series, The Last Devil to Die, is out now, and that's the book we're talking about today. But I want to go back to Thursday Murder Club. So that was released in COVID.
Yeah.
And your first fiction book?
Yeah.
Was it your first book ever or just your first fiction?
Well, I'd written various sort of TV tie-in books, you know, comedy books and things like that. But yeah, this was, I mean, I'd written a lot. I'd done a lot of journalism, done a lot of sitcom writing and things like that in my younger years. And, you know, I'd started various novels as everybody does.
Yeah.
But this is the first time I just thought, no, I've got the time now to take it seriously. I think I know probably a tiny more about the world than I did when I was younger. And, you know, it stuck. I just started writing and I was at 20,000 words and 30,000.
Yeah.
And I thought it's going to be more painful to stop writing now than it is to carry on. So, I did it. I'm delighted I did.
Yeah. What do you think has resonated with people? Because, you know, it's a phenomena for a book. Do you know, I was only saying this to somebody the other day. And you might agree or disagree, but I really believe that books that come out and do really well are of the moment. Like, I feel, like, say, for instance, Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code, I would say that if that came out now, that maybe it wouldn't have done as well as it did at the time. You know, and I think that books sometimes lend themselves to the mood of... what's happening in our world?
Well, honestly, my view of that would be, you know, my whole career I've been a creative, so I've come up with ideas and that's the idea. And the thought is that you have to work out what the public want before the public know what they want. So I would say, you know, Dan Brown had probably worked out there was a gap in the market 2 years before anyone else did. So by the time his book came out, that gap was apparent and, you know, he could sell books. And the same, you know, I was sort of looking around for a book like The Thursday Murder Club. And I couldn't find it. Something that wasn't sort of gory or kind of a psychological thriller with an unreliable narrator, but was a proper kind of old-fashioned mystery and adventure and that had some humour and wit and warmth to it, but wasn't cosy, wasn't sort of, you know, someone in a selling sweets in a seaside town. And so I couldn't find that book. And then 2 years later,
it comes out. A book that maybe if you'd pitched it to a publisher 10 years ago or 15 years ago, oh, it's going to be set in a nursing home and it's got a whole bunch of old people, people would have thought, nah, hang on a second, I don't think we can find an audience for that. But I feel that... because you've learnt more, like we're growing older, and we realise that the knowledge and the interest and the integrity and all the things that people that have lived longer give us makes, that's kind of, I think the mood around that has changed as well.
I do think that's right. I think you know, the good thing was, and lots of people who've sold books will know this, is I didn't pitch it off an idea. I wrote the whole thing. I didn't tell anyone I was doing it.
Yeah.
I just thought, you know, I had faith in the idea for the reasons you're saying, is that I knew I had this group of people who could do something very interesting in the middle of our culture, which wasn't currently being done. So I knew I had that. And then I just thought, now I've got to write a great book as well.
Yeah.
But I had that. And so actually when I sent it to publishers and what have you, I wasn't kind of asking them to buy into the idea. I was saying, well, look, read this.
Yeah.
And, you know, they got caught up in the characters and the story and we sold it. So I think that it's, you know, people often say, and as I say, my whole career coming up with ideas, people often say, oh, it's interesting because I think people were ready for something quite warm. And I think culturally we're always ready for something quite warm. We're always ready for something that shines, you know, that has some bite, but also shines a light on goodness as well. Mm. And, you know, at any time we've made TV shows like that, there's a reason the biggest shows in Britain are, you know, the Bake Off and, you know, Strictly Come Dancing. Mm. People like celebrations of humanity. That's what people like, so long as you've got something else
but
as well.
But I also think we've been a bit ageist. I think various cultural groups aren't. Like Indigenous people in Australia have a really high regard for their elders.
Yeah.
Whereas here there has been, and I don't know if it's the same in the UK, but there is a tension around getting older. There's also a stigma around getting older and there's a stigma around nursing homes, you know, or aged care facilities.
Yeah.
And, you know, my mum, I've talked about this a lot on this podcast, she died 18 months ago and she was in a nursing home.
Yeah.
She had dementia. And it was very contentious.
Yeah.
Lebanese-Australian family, you know, half my family agreed, half didn't.
Yeah.
People saw nursing home or aged care facility as this big, you know, horrible lock-up prison, never to be seen again. And it was during COVID. However, I witness some of the most beautiful acts in the carers and the patients in that facility. And if you were to sit back and collect stories, I got so many, Richard. And one was, and my mother was never a dancer, right? She was, you know, very stoic, firm matriarch. And one night I was in there persuading her to take these tablets. And this young nurse, full PPE gear, this young nurse came up to her. He would have been 25, 26. And he said, "Antoinette, come and dance with me."
Wow. Mm. I mean, it's, you know, it's, I write a lot about dementia in these books, and particularly in the most recent one, The Last Devil to Die, and it's very important to me because, as you know, very few families haven't been touched by it one way or another.
Mm.
And I was talking to the head of one of the dementia charities in the UK, and she said, if you've met one patient with dementia, then you've met one patient with dementia. Okay, it's different for everybody.
Everyone.
So, you know, I think about my grandfather, who both my grandparents spent their last years with dementia, but my grandmother declined in a very, very different way. But my grandfather, you could still sit and chat for many years. And I found it fascinating to work out what connections he was losing, what connections he was keeping, what skills he still had and what skills he never remembered that he ever had, how time worked for him. So I thought a lot about that. And the two things I really, really remember and took with me and tried to put in the books was, however down he was and however awful things could be, we were always laughing.
Mm.
You know, 2 minutes later, there was always laughter, always. And also I remember love being the thing that just endured. Mm. That was the real power within him, understanding he was loved and understanding he was with someone who he loved as well.
Mm.
And so I wanted to write someone undergoing dementia, which I've done in the fourth book. I mean, Stephen's had it for the first three books, but I go into it in more detail. And trying not to... I just wanted to sort of talk about him, really, and how it must, and how it feels for him, and how his mind is working, and how it's whirring.
Mm.
And I've, you know, had so many chats now to people who've read the book and who've had, you know, parents or family members with dementia, who have been incredibly positive about it. Which is because all I could write about was the bit I knew, you know. And it's nice to know that it's resonated with people.
Mm. You know, one of the things I noticed too about the dementia patients in this aged care facility, and my mother, I mean, it's a horrible, horrible disease and there's not much to like about it, but you had to go with it, right?
Yeah, exactly that.
You had to go with it. And then we would, you know, I'd go in some days and she'd have red nail polish on and a pink headband. Now, she'd never done that before. She'd never wore nail polish, you know. And I just thought, well, maybe it's a new, like, it's reinventing yourself, right?
You know, I mean, we are inexact machines.
Yes.
You know, and almost all literature is about, you know, the dissonance between what happens in the world and how we experience it. And in Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia, it's all about that.
Yeah.
You know, it's how we're experiencing reality and how we experience our reality. And writing about it, I found very, very moving, you know, because, you know, all of us are not exactly standing square onto reality, are we?
None of us. Look, I've got to tell you, I felt it was very grounding going there. And if you were open to going with it and, you know, you could collect so many stories in a day.
No, absolutely.
And all of them would make you cry, you know.
That's exactly right.
I want to go back to the first book and to talk about, so you were already successful in your own right, and then you wrote Thursday Murder Club, and it resonated. It found an audience almost immediately.
Yeah.
How is that in terms of life changing? How did that work for you?
Do you know what? No one wants to hear this answer, but it wasn't life changing at all. Only because, you know, I'd spent, since I was 20, I've worked in television.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've had a few hits and a lot of failures.
Yeah.
I've had good shows that failed. I've had bad shows that have succeeded. So my relationship with success and failure has sort of been blunted over the years. And I do treat those two imposters just the same.
Mm.
So for me, there was no sort of, you know, it didn't make me feel validated or anything. I loved it, you know, because I love the books. And the more people who read it, the happier I am.
Mm.
And I love it.
And the happier they are.
Yeah, exactly. Because it spreads happiness.
That's,
you know,
right.
And that's all I'm really interested in is entertaining people. So it's lovely to come over to Australia and America and Germany and meet readers. So I love all of that. It opens up a new world to me. But in terms of, did I feel that the success was something that, you know, gave something to my life? No, because I'd long ago, my relationship with success was cast in concrete a long, long time ago. And you have to just get up in the morning and do your best that day, I think.
Do you know, Richard, I've had a long career as well. I'm older than you, but and I, you know, I've had a good career, but I've had some duds.
Yes.
Right?
Oh,
I've been retrenched.
Yeah.
I've had some duds.
Yeah.
I've had some really bad jobs. I've had mostly fantastic jobs, but I feel as though in my last quarter, which I think is now, that I hit the jackpot.
Great. But, you know, that's when you should be hitting the jackpot, isn't it? Because you should have worked out at some point. You think, hold on, I keep doing these things and they don't work.
Yeah.
And you work out, oh, these things make me happy. Is there any way I can just work out how to monetize these things that make me happy just long enough that it keeps me going?
That's right.
And, you know, that's all you can ask for, isn't it? But to be paid to do something that you enjoy to do, that's the ultimate goal, isn't it? And, you know, if you're in your last half or your last quarter or your last eighth, you know, it's there's a sense of urgency to enjoy yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
And to be yourself.
Earlier today, I went to the Lebanese bakery to buy, I decided I'll shout the office some lunch, all my crew. And I ran into my inner Lebanese bakery, because my parents are Lebanese Australian. I ran into my cousin, one of Mum's cousin's son, Joseph, and he was in the bakery. And he said, "Well, can you have a coffee with me?" And I said, yeah. So we sat down, we had a coffee. And, you know, I don't see him that often, but he's beautiful, lovely, lovely man. And he said to me, "How did you get the best job in the world?"
Yeah.
He said, "I follow you on Instagram and you've just got the best job." And I thought, yeah, I don't know how I got here. It's like you. It's just one thing. And, you know, some careers are quite linear, aren't they?
Yes, exactly.
And others, I mean, seriously, yes, I've been in the book industry for 40 years,
but
it's been in different things.
Yeah.
And now I just get to come in and do all the good things, like talk to you.
Well, that's it. And you have to love stuff. And,
yes.
You know, eventually, you have to sort of hang around long enough that, do you remember in your 20s and 30s when you were so terrified to ask for, like, a pay rise.
I used to practice it.
You wanted a slightly different bit to your job, and you were like, it was like mortifying, because you were thinking, well, they can't. And then you work out after a while, you think, oh, everyone's bluffing.
Yes.
Everyone at every level of this organisation is bluffing. And actually, sort of, they want me to hang around.
Mm.
And so maybe I'll just sort of start doing something slightly different. Mm. And, you know, then they'll have to put up with me. They're not going to fire me. That's a pain for them. I'm not going to be, ask for like loads more money. I'm just going to start doing the stuff I like.
Yeah.
And the book industry, you can sort of do that in. And and eventually you've carved out a career that no one else has had.
Yeah. I remember being on the bus going for a job interview at Dimmicks, right? And
it
was, I think it was a store manager role. I can't even remember whether I got it or not. Although back then you kind of got every job you applied for.
Oh,
but
really?
Anyway, I think that's different now.
Yeah.
But I wanted $30,000 a year, right? $30,000. And I remember on the bus just $30,000, $30,000, $30,000. Just practicing that.
Don't,
so I can
like,
say it. So it just came out so naturally.
But my daughter is now in the world of work and she's you know, the very little advice I can still give my daughter, but in terms of she wanted to get a pay rise, or she just got a slightly new job and she was trying to work out what she wanted to pay. And she said, they've offered X and I want X, which was $5,000 more than they'd offered. So she said, how do I go about it? I said, well, look, you're going to go into a room and the person you're talking to, nothing personal is going on here, but he has one job and that's to get out of that room with the $5,000 in his pocket and not in your pocket, right? That's his only job. And if he does that 9 times out of 10, then he's doing his job. Right, but you just be the 1 time out of 10 because he's either going to have the money or you are. It's not like no one's going to starve, and the company's not going to go broke.
Yeah.
So go and be unbelievably polite. Give him the problem. Just say, oh look, you know it's hard for me because I love it here, but I just you know there's extra money elsewhere. But if we can find a way, if we can get to $5,000 now, I'll shake your hand and you know we're done.
Yeah,
and
it's
the
she
way to do it.
It.
Yeah, well, yeah, of course you got it because you know he doesn't mind about $5,000 really. No. He just needs to make sure he doesn't do that to everyone.
No, and he needs some negotiating room.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember years ago that was my first time I got retrenched. Now we knew 800 people were getting retrenched, and it was. Back, you
is
know,
retrenched been made redundant?
Yes.
Is that the Australian?
Yes, made redundant. It was called retrenchment. I don't know whether it... Yeah, both words apply, but I think it was called retrenched at the time. And it was a really big company. 800 people were going that day. We all knew it, right?
Yeah.
And then it happened. So they put you in a room, you know, about this size and, oh, no, terrible, terrible, right? That was the lowest part of my career, right? Because I just never thought it would be me, because you never do, right?
Yeah, of course.
And then I walk in the room and I'm super nervous, but I'd worked out from seeing people come and go that if you got the red folder, you were gone. If you got the green folder,
oh, no.
I mean, how stupid of them to run it that way, right? Anyway, so sure enough, the red folder was out when I got in there and I knew it. So it was an absolute panic in my head.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, pull out a stalling tactic because this is your career, this is your livelihood, and just say no to everything. Now, I don't know why, but I just did it. I just so that's it, you're finishing up today? No. And the guy's like, you've got no choice. No, I'm not going. Anyway, because I was so nervous, because I was so shattered, I got double what they were giving me.
Wow.
And I ended up walking out with something like $200,000, like a lot of money.
Like a lot.
And I remember ringing a friend of mine who was an accountant. He said, Cheryl, you've just won the lottery.
Yeah.
This is what I'm telling you. Turn this around. It's not negative. It's positive.
You don't like doing that job anyway.
No. You're never going to get that much money as a lump sum.
Yeah.
And then when I turn that around, oh, I've won the lottery. Okay, well, that's different.
Yeah, exactly.
And
right.
That's how you deal with things, right?
Never waste a crisis, right?
That's
the way to live.
So tell me about growing up. And were you a voracious reader? Were you a writer? How is it that you came to loving story?
I was a voracious writer, for sure. I was never a voracious reader. I've got... My eyesight is very, very, very bad. So I'm very visually impaired. So the audiobooks for me are like a dream. But younger, I'm looking at books and it would take me so long to read. So when I was very young, it was easy because I'd read Enid Blyton and Famous Five and I absolutely loved it.
Right.
Then when I get to slightly older books, I literally can't. So it's not... You know,
and audiobooks were like, you know, 27 cassettes.
I mean, exactly. Yeah, exactly. They did not exist back then.
But they were so bulky.
Yeah, exactly. So it was only in my 20s, really, actually, that I got back into it and sort of found a way of kind of training my eyes to read these things. But I always wrote, for sure.
Yeah.
I did lots of journalism in my 20s. But
and did you want to be a journalist?
Yeah, I did, really. I wanted to be a sports writer. I think if you'd asked me what I wanted to be, I would have said sports writer. And then I got a job in TV just from the newspaper. And I thought, of course, what I want to be in is TV because that's what I watch. But I didn't even know you could work in television.
Yeah.
You know,
who got those jobs?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It didn't occur to me that that was a job.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I did that, which is great, and enabled me to keep writing within the realms of TV as well, and, you know, joke writing and sitcom writing and things like that. So it was, I've always got a pad and a pen in front of me, and I have done since I was sort of 5 years old. Yeah. I always want to be doodling or writing something or just jotting things down. And it's now I've turned that into a career somehow.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Because I'm you know, a book reader, so fiction or non-fiction, I've, you know, people over the years have shown me a script or a screenplay or something, and I can never work it out. Like, it's so few words.
I know.
I don't know what the hell's going on.
Yeah, I find novel writing easier than script writing is the truth.
Talk to me about that.
Because, you know, in scripts, you do have to have a really, really kind of visual imagination to read a script. You know, there's no point reading it as dialogue because it's, you know, it's you need to be seeing the action. You need to be sort of hearing the music, hearing the score, seeing the colours. And if you do that, you can work out where the beats of the story are. Whereas in a book, in a novel, you know, I love to be inside people's heads, which is, of course, the first thing that goes when a book is transferred to the screen. The first thing that goes is those lovely sort of paragraph-long things of someone, you know, worrying about something or thinking, have I just said the right thing? Have I embarrassed myself? Just anything that goes on in your head, all of that goes. And those are the bits that I love
writing. So when you're writing scripts, I mean, sometimes it looks to me like it's a couple of hundred words or a thousand words or whatever. And now you're going to, what, 80,000, 90,000?
Yeah, 90,000, yeah.
What was that transition like in terms of discipline and how you approach work? Like, did you then go to a writer's studio or how did you work that out?
No, I loved it. I you know, I write very short chapters.
Right,
Which, you know, it's sort of for my own attention, but actually for readers, I find that incredibly useful. If I read a book with short chapters, I'm so happy.
Yeah.
You know,
it gives it a pace, doesn't it?
Dan Brown was very short chapters, you know, and I did the same, but I wasn't thinking, oh, this is the way to write a hit book. I was just thinking, I like to finish a chapter in a day. You know, that's what I like to do. I like to write 1,000, 1,500 words, and I like a beginning, middle, and an end of a chapter. I like to have moved the story on a little bit.
And do you do that every day?
Yeah. I wish I did it every day. That would make my life so much easier. I do it as many days as I have to.
Right,
because, you know, I try and do a book a year.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that feels like a contract that I've signed with readers.
And
you know,
it's
to say,
work. It's,
And, you know, I'll only do sort of 2 hours, but that 2 hours will be phone off, internet off, you know, my fingers don't leave the typewriter, you know, the keyboard typewriter. I'm not from the 1940s. And so, you know, I'm very good at, once I've sat down, I'm very, very focused and, you know, my brain works quickly and, you know, the characters kind of, you know, guide me through a scene. But yeah, I don't plan or plot or I have an idea.
Do you write linear?
Do I write?
Linear, beginning to end?
No. Well, do you know what? Yes, I sort of do, is the truth. But but I don't know what's going to happen. And quite often you'll find you're writing in a linear fashion. The book I'm writing at the moment, there's a scene I've just written, and it's occurred to me that actually it's going to have to happen towards the end rather than the beginning. So it's still there, so I put it in another folder, so it's still going to happen, but it's done. But yeah, by and large, it's what's next, what's next, what's next, because that's how you read a book.
Yeah.
And so I sort of think it's useful, you know, and that's how you write. But often in the rewriting process, you have to go back and add extra scenes in to make sense of the thing you came up with, you know, on the last page. You go, oh, hold on, I need to reverse engineer, you know, how that's going to work. But yeah, by and large, I'll start at the start and end at the end.
When you delivered your first book, what was the experience, the editorial process? Because that would have been very different for you as well.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because in TV, everyone's got an opinion and everyone's opinion counts.
Right.
So they are, you know, they are allowed to chop and change your program. They're allowed to edit it. They're, you know, you have to, if the client wants you to change the program in a certain way, you have to. And in publishing, you don't have to change a word, which is crazy.
Yeah.
You know, it's too light touch for me. You know, they are. Well, this is your art, so
Should I be careful? They might be listening to this.
No, don't, because I told them. I said, listen, I need. You know, I like to. Yeah. And that first book, because you know, I threw everything at it, and there were sort of too many subplots, and so you know, they're going, okay, we cut stuff out. I worked out how you make things simpler, and you know, from then on, I sort of know what the notes are going to be. If I'm doing something that's overcomplicated, or I'm doing something that bores me, or I'm doing something that you know. You've sort of done this bit before. I just cut them out immediately, and now the note sessions are much, much, much lower. And also, I deliver quite late, so they don't have as much time. But that first one, yeah, the interesting thing was make it simpler.
Yes.
So I wasn't ever having to add stuff. I'd lost about 15,000 words and a couple of subplots, and we were there, and that was the final book, pretty much. But yeah, I find it extraordinary how few notes there are in publishing, as opposed to TV.
And it's very polite.
Oh, I mean, it's so polite. I mean, it's crazily polite. You know, I'm used to telly, which is 100 miles an hour and everyone working, you know, all the hours God sends and all of that. And it's great fun.
Yes.
I mean, TV, when it's a team and you've got proper bosses who are not, you know, it can become toxic because of that. But if it's not toxic, if it's like a gang and you're making something, it's like a joy. And the thing I love about publishing is when I finish writing and suddenly you're in a team again.
Yeah.
Because you're with your salespeople and your publishers and your booksellers. You know, I'm an industry guy. I love you know, rolling my sleeves up and going and selling books. And that's the thing I love to do because that's where everyone's...
It's part of the job.
That's where bookshops come from. That's where publishers come from.
That's right.
You have to sell books.
Yeah, and that's where we come from.
Yeah, exactly.
In terms of humour, has that been easier to translate into long form as well? Like, because you aren't, you know, you're so funny. But to get that onto a page... I would say it would be a bit harder. Is it harder?
No, I find it... You know, your brain works in a certain way. Your brain has a certain default.
Yeah.
And mine is either humour or it's pathos. Or so, you know, that's just my natural reaction. And I have characters... I never write any jokes.
No.
I've never... I never sit down and think, what would be funny here? Ever.
Yeah.
Ever. I never, ever do. But I write one sentence and then another sentence would occur to me that's funny.
Yeah.
Or someone will do a line of dialogue, you know, Joyce will say something and you think, oh, that's funny because of character. But yeah, so there's never me thinking, oh, what would be funny? What could I say that's funny here?
Yeah,
it's just the first thing my brain thinks of occasionally is funny.
Yeah.
So I write that down. But yeah, the rule basically in these books is don't write jokes. No one-liners, nothing you could put in a stand-up act. Let all the comedy come from the characters and the situations you put them in, and then it doesn't get in the way of the mystery or the truth of the book.
I think, and you'll have a good sense of this, I watch film, I like TV, you know, I'm liking TV more. A lot of when I'm, and I always, before I watch anything, I do a whole lot of research around it, and a lot of the conversation I see around film in particular or a TV series is people talk about, you know, their experience on set and that they knew it was going to be a success because everything fell into place and, you know, whatever, whatever. Did you feel that with the first book? Did you feel that you've got something really special?
No, and also, I never, ever buy that. It's always nonsense. That's always post-rationalised.
Well, you've
always just
ruined that for me.
Well, because every time you're on a set, people go, you do a pilot and go, oh my God, the camera operators were laughing so much, I think this is a hit. And it's always meaningless. It's always meaningless because will make a show and, you know, you'll do it and then it goes out and you'll see it on screen and you go, oh, of course, it's rubbish. And no, we didn't spot it. We just didn't know. Or sometimes you'll go, this is good, and people will go, no. Not absolutely not interested at all. No, the truth is, very occasionally you'll do something and you'll think, oh, okay, I think we did the first ever Deal or No Deal in the UK. And that's one of the few times where we'd made the pilot and I thought, I think people are going to go absolutely nuts for this show.
Yeah.
That if I had to put money on it, I think they will. And it's one of the few times I've been proved right. But no, with the first book, I thought, and with all the books when they come out, I thought, this doesn't feel like anyone else's book, so I think this might disappear or people are not going to like it. And when people started liking it, that was, you know, when you talk about
they
things...
They instantly liked it, not started.
Well, when I say started, I sort of mean you send it to an agent and then you send it to publishers and then it goes... So, you know, and so people are suddenly reading this thing
that
was from your brain and people started saying, oh, this is... You know, and other writers who I respected started reading it and enjoyed it. And I thought that took me by surprise because I don't think anyone's ever written a book finishes it and goes, I've got a good one there. This is, oh, I got a winner now. And every time I bring a new one out, I think, yeah, I knew I'd run out of ideas at some point. I knew I'd be found out. And so far it's been okay. But no, you can't, because all you can see is what's wrong with it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because you start with this big slab of marble and you've got this idea of this perfect, beautiful kind of Michelangelo's David that you're going to carve out of it. Yeah. And, you know, you can go, oh, it's a nice arm, I suppose, and that's a good foot. But like, you're missing, like, and that nose looks awful and those eyes, and so that's all you can see.
Yeah, yeah.
But you forget that when people read or when they watch TV, they are wrapped up in the story and the characters. They will sort of gloss over. There's bits in my books that when I read them, I go, come on, mate. Mm-hmm. Really? You let that go through?
Yeah.
But everyone knows that about books.
Yeah.
If our favourite books are some terrible sentences. And so I love reading it in Agatha Christie, and sometimes there's like a real clunker of a sentence. And I'm like, thank you, Agatha.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, because now I feel better about my clunkers as well. Yeah.
A lot of first writers say to me that writing their first book was the best because they're anonymous, you know, in a way that they had... There was no pressure. They didn't have a two-book contract. They, you know, that they were writing in a kind of a state of bliss or separate to any kind of expectation. Mm. But you already had a profile. You already were known to people. Mm. So to put that book out is really, I'd imagine, could have been quite scary, because what about if it was a flop? I mean, you're kind of dealing with that if that were to happen.
Yeah, but again, honestly, when I talk about the success not making a difference, the flop wouldn't have either. I would have been proud to have written it.
Would you?
You know, anyone who's finished a novel, I mean, it's a real...
I want to be Richard Osman.
Achievement. Yeah, but you know what I mean? That's a real achievement. And if it hadn't worked... Listen, don't get me wrong. I'm happier it succeeded.
Yes.
Right?
So I
take what's happened over that. But if it had flopped, that's okay. Plenty of people bring up one novel and people don't read it. But,
oh,
you know,
course.
It's on their shelf forever. And,
yeah.
And
Da Vinci Code was the fourth.
And exactly that. You know, just, you know, these things happen. And it's I knew that people knew how I was. But I liked the book by the time it came out, because I'd had this feedback. And, you know, Germany were buying the rights and China were buying the rights in these countries where they didn't know who I was.
Mm.
And I thought, oh, okay, there's something in this. So
did China buy the rights?
Yeah, everyone's bought that. You know, it's like in every country in the world. And so I was thinking, well, something... I thought the worst that can happen is it just disappears.
Yeah.
I thought, I don't think I've written an absolutely terrible book here, because people seem to like it. So I think, well, look, I've got away with it, whatever happens. But everything else on top of that has been icing on the cake.
So I've been in the business for a long time. I'm not going to say 40 years, but I think it is 40 years. But anyway, and I have lived through phenomena, right?
Yeah.
You know, Jaws, do you remember that?
Yeah.
Of course, Da Vinci Code. I was working for Random House at the time, and Harry Potter. And the thing I have about phenomena, and now Richard Osman is another phenomena, is the book world, and this is a little bit visual, so I'll try and describe it to you. So there's this many people that read all of the time, and what I'm describing here is a smaller circle right? And then you go out and there are some people that start reading around the edges, and maybe like that Stephen Hawking, A Brief History of Time, that was on the top, you know, bestseller list for years and years, but not the same kind of bang phenomena.
Yeah.
And then you go out to Da Vinci Code, to Harry Potter, to Richard Osman. And that is readers that don't usually read.
Yeah.
And that's the phenomena, isn't it? When you get that audience and they are so compelled to read it. And well, that's story. That's based on story.
Yeah, I really think it is. And I think that coming from television really helped me. So, I'd been in a situation with the Thursday Murder Club that, you know, I remember when we sold our first million, and you could see in the publishers, quite rightly, they were very, very happy with themselves and what they'd done, and they'd done this great campaign and all of this, and, you know, you could see. And I'd be in there and they go, well, I don't think we can sell anymore. I go, we haven't sold any.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I didn't, not in a mean way, but I said, but actually, you know, I can make a TV show that 15 million people watch.
Mm.
You sold a million books, which is sort of, you know, that's an afternoon show on BBC One. That isn't anyone. To sell books, you have to sell books to people who don't read books. That's the key.
Did you say that at the time?
Oh, 100%.
You were reading my mind at the time.
But it's true, right?
And it is.
But also, if you do that, then those people will go into a bookshop.
Yeah.
And those people, so many people said, oh, you've got me back into reading, or, you know, my dad doesn't read any books, reads this, and now he's reading Lee Child. And you bring people into the world of books. You're like a gateway drug for people. And, you know, there's something about the books and the pace of them and the characters that people who don't often read feel very comfortable reading. And I say it constantly. Even now, Thursday Murder Club in the UK is selling, you know, 8,000 books a week. These are people. Yeah. I said most people don't even know I've written books.
Yeah.
You can be the biggest phenomenon in the world in books. Mm. And actually, a lot of people on the street would not have the first clue. You know, you have to be like movies or television or music. You know, you have to get out there and you have to really, really sell. Mm. And if you do that, then the whole market goes up.
Mm. No, you did right. Do you know, because I've been in the industry for so long, you know, I go out and, you know, dinner party, whatever, over the years, and this would be the stick. If I said to somebody, you know, I work in publishing or I work in bookselling, the women would say, and, you know, I'm being gender specific here because that's what it was, what do you recommend I read next? This is the last book I read and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I can do that.
Yeah.
If you tell me what your last two books are, I can tell you what your next two books
are.
Oh, that's
great. I like
that. Yeah, because I've been doing it for a long time.
Yeah.
However, without a doubt, almost every male would say, oh, I haven't read a book since high school.
Yep,
right? And then once the phenomena started kicking in, I would hear, oh, I read The Da Vinci Code or I read Harry Potter or whatever. So that's that audience.
Yeah.
That's who we get to.
I mean,
to.
It's, you know, I'm obsessed with all the statistics and stuff. The poor sales team at Penguin UK, I'm always... No, but the good thing about the sales team, they're obsessed with them as well, aren't they?
Yeah.
They suddenly go, oh, an author who wants to see all the graphs. And I want to see the graphs. So I see everything. And the gender split on Thursday Murder Club is fascinating because it's sort of half and half.
Yes.
And there aren't any books that are half and half.
You know, there are very few.
There are either books, you know, if any men read a book, then that book is read by all... It's the entire readership is men. It's quite rare to have a book that crosses across. So I love that. The age thing is incredibly, you know...
Which is wonderful.
Amazing. I love that.
Because empathy.
Exactly that. Mm-hmm. And the whole point about trying to... Yeah. have these older heroes is it's not just read by older people. Mm. Older people already know their heroes. Mm. You know, it's nice to be read by younger people. So, yeah, I absolutely love that. I love looking at all the numbers, just every chart, all the sales chart, all the kind of demographics and stuff like that. It's absolutely, that's my dream. I loved it in TV when you get the overnight viewing figures every day. Mm-hmm. And I love it in books. You only get it once a week, which frustrates me, but I love to read it.
I think that's when they get it once a week. So being visually impaired and audiobooks, I want to talk a little bit about audio because I'm a little bit addicted now. Tell me when that started for you. Like, when did you start? Because they're getting better and better as well.
Amazing, Of course, that's a really good question. And I honestly couldn't tell you the answer. I guess it's when we had, like... little iPods and stuff, wasn't it?
You could
start downloading things. Yeah, because I don't think I was ever... I had the odd sort of CD that I would listen to, and like in the car and stuff like that. But yeah, it's the digital thing that's really kind of paid off, I think. And, you know, and it's such a growing market. All audio is
a gift.
Growing market. It's
for
amazing.
For so many people.
Oh, I mean, for me, it's a dream because I can... A book takes me about half the time. If I'm reading Lessons in Chemistry, I'm going to be there a long time.
Mm.
If I'm listening to Lessons
in
Chemistry,
that's another phenomena.
Exactly.
Bonnie Gellman. Yeah,
you know, I can just wander around. I can go to the gym. I can walk. You know, I can walk to go to work, and I can listen to the whole book, and the voice of it stays in my head, and I feel very, very close to it.
Yeah, there's an intimacy about it.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah,
and I love that. Shall I tell you how I would change audiobooks?
Yeah.
Shall I tell you the thing that drives me mad about audiobooks?
Because I might pick it up as a business idea or something.
Right. I do the same. Right. You'll do an audio extra, which is like, so in my last audiobook, Last Devil to Die, I do an interview with Fiona Shaw, who reads the book. Right. Mm-hmm. So we did like a 25-minute interview. There is no indication when you are reading that and you're looking at how much time you've got left that there is a 25-minute. So you think, oh, I've still got 25 minutes left, and the book ends. And that happened with Lessons in Chemistry. Bonnie Garmus was doing an interview at the end of it, and I just thought, oh, we've got about two or three chapters left. I wonder what's going to happen. And there's a paragraph. You think, oh, it's finished. And that drives me insane. You need to say, the book has got 2% left, or the book has got 7 minutes okay. left, and then there is a 25-minute extra. That's what I would change. It drives me
okay,
absolutely
well,
insane.
Okay, well, one of our sponsors is Belinda Audio, who produce a lot of Australian audiobooks, yeah. and hopefully they're listening. And then maybe you can call up someone at Audible and yeah. tell them that.
I don't know how you would do it. But you know what I mean? Like when you're reading a book, you know when you got to the end, right? It's like you're on the last page.
And that is part of the story, isn't it?
Yeah. Like, you know,
it's hugely part of the story.
Well, because if you need to know you're coming to the end of a story.
Yes.
Because the writer knows. Mm. So the writer is lulling you into somewhere he wants you to be or she wants you to be, you know, and the pace is changing and the language is changing. But if you don't know, then your brain is not in that. Your brain is still, I wonder what's going to happen next. You think, oh, nothing is going to happen next. Mm. It's a minor thing, but it drives me mad, and I wonder if it drives other people mad.
Yeah, you feel a little bit shortchanged, right? So tell me, first time in Australia?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Taking a little sip of water there.
Yeah.
A little bit behind the scenes. Well, I've been here 2.5 days.
Yeah.
I have rarely been out of a TV or radio or podcast studio.
Even though the weather's gorgeous.
In all that time. It's lovely. Yeah. Funny enough, I did a TV thing this morning and I walked back across Sydney Harbour Bridge to the hotel, which is it's so beautiful.
Yeah.
And I've never been to Australia. Obviously, Britain and Australia have such close connections.
We do.
So it's one of those places you go to that you kind of go, yeah, I'm very familiar with this.
Yes.
But, you know, you're not kind of going, oh, my goodness, what's this place with
I feel that it's... Because I lived in London for a couple of years. Yeah, I worked at Dillon's. Remember Dillon's?
Oh, I do remember Dillon's,
I worked at Dillon's at High Street, Ken.
Yeah.
But yes, there's a familiarity, but there's also a huge difference as well.
Yes, I see that. So I've only been in Sydney so far. I'm just heading off to Brisbane and Melbourne.
But you know Sydney's the best.
Well, it's really beautiful.
It is beautiful.
I love it. And, you know, I've only been in the central bit, but, you know, the architecture I really love. Of course, the quay is wonderful and the harbour. So, yeah, I love it, but it's I keep waiting for the jet lag to kick in. So I can't quite relax into it. But I love it. It's beautiful.
You should be over the jet lag now.
Do you think? I really hope so, because maybe I've escaped it. How have I managed that?
Yeah, maybe you've done that.
Surely not.
Yeah, no, that can happen. I mean, I think if you're not feeling anything day two, you'd know.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a really long, long journey.
Oh, my God. It's so long. Fly Dubai. And I missed a day in the air. I was like, hold on. I left on Friday. Now it's Sunday. What happened to Saturday?
That's right. But you get it the other way around.
Yeah, exactly.
There's payback.
But it's I love Australia. Britain loves Australia.
We
really, really do. And to be here and to talk to Australian readers, it's so funny, though, because it's not like talking to German readers. You think, I wonder what German people think of this. Because talking to Australian readers, you're like, there's such a familiarity.
There is.
That, you know, and so talking to Australian readers is like talking to British readers. It's sort of the same thing.
Well, and also traditionally, like over the years, a lot of our book content came from the UK.
Yeah.
I mean, that was such a close relationship. Not as so much now because we're publishing more here.
Yeah.
But for a long time, it was really largely books published in the UK.
And it's not in translation or any of that.
No,
so I feel a real kinship. But it's I feel like I need to come back for like a month and like properly, you know.
Yeah.
Do
immerse
the country.
Yourself.
Immerse myself, exactly. And start to annoy the Australians a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah,
start to be
ubiquitous. That would be nice. That would be good.
Richard Osmond, thank you so much for your time. If you'd like more information about Better Reading, follow us on Facebook or visit betterreading.com.au.
This podcast is proudly sponsored by Belinda Audio. Belinda audiobooks are available on CD and MP3 from online booksellers and bookshops everywhere, or you can download from Audible, Google Play, or the iBook Store. We've also created our own app called BorrowBox that's available from both the App Store and Google Play. All you need to do to get it working is to download the app, join your local public library, and you'll gain access to the world's best collection of ebooks and e-audiobooks available for you to loan on your phone or your personal device. Belinda, we're here to enable you to escape, imagine, grow, and be inspired through the power of storytelling. Belinda Audiobooks. Anywhere, everywhere.
Thank you. deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
If you enjoyed this podcast, leave us a review and check out the other podcasts on the Better Reading Network.